You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with editor, author, and painter, Adam Moss.
This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why I wrote the book, which are separate from the question about how the book is composed the way it is. But I've always been interested as a human and as a journalist in artifacts of the making of anything. I think that they're beautiful and extremely telling, that they provide a kind of map of, in the case of artists and the artist's mind, as they're making the thing, they're very honest. They're not distorted by memory and the other sorts of things that come when people try to make sense of what it is that they've done. I always love these. I love drafts of things. I love scribbles and doodles, outlines, crazy outlines, and lyric fragments on hotel stationery. I just love all that stuff. So when I got the idea to do this book, I thought it would be especially interesting if I could find as many of these artifacts as were available to me, basically presented them to the artists as a way to prompt their remembering about how to do this thing and explaining their thinking, their state of mind. I was very interested in the state of mind of an artist as he or she goes about making the thing. I've worked in magazines all my life. I'm really interested in the way that text interplays with images, and I always felt that books were a little antiquated in that regard, and that they had the quality that you're describing, which is that they look kind of alike, and you have to go hunt for the images, and maybe sometimes the images are all grouped in the center. But in any case, there's a lack of dynamism. So when I wanted to do this book, I wanted, one of my interests was to make a book that didn't look like any other book. Basically, then I worked with the designer and his team that I had worked with as a magazine editor, Luke Heyman and Pentagram. And I charged them with the idea of making a book that would sort of toggle easily between the imagery we were talking about and the words, my words, the words of the artists. I wanted to create a form where the artists were given room to talk themselves about what it is that they were doing. But then I created this kind of elaborate, almost Talmudic footnote structure, so that I could talk without getting in their way. I could talk about what they were talking about and also lace in my own thoughts and fears and doubts and my own argument with them and my own little traces of my own memoir where they were relevant, because part of the book also, it's a kind of search book to try to understand why I was having so much trouble learning how to paint. I think one of the things that artists do have, not just an interest in their own subconscious, but also an ability to find ways, tricks, hacks, all these sorts of things to get into their subconscious. And then over time, they understand how to make productive use of what they find there. We all have consciousnesses. We all dream. We all daydream. We all have kind of disassociated thoughts that float through our head, but we don't generally know what to do with them. One of the traits that successful artists seem to have is this ability to cross borders into the recesses of their own heads. The artists would be my collaborators. I would talk to them and present their own work in the same way that I was, as an editor, presenting the work of writers. And then I would intrude in a more transparent way than you can in a magazine. That, in the end, worked out. I was the interviewer. I was the composer of the various images. All the magazine parts I did all by myself. So that was a very different kind of experience for me. When I was working at the Times and working at the Times Magazine, one Tuesday morning, the towers fell. Wow. 9/11, 2001. And the magazine had a 10-day lead time, so that it was a weekly, 10 days old by the time it came out. And we came to work and realized the world had changed. And the entire process, the magazine had been made for 100 and some years, had to be thrown out the window. And we had to make a new magazine in 36 hours that would in some way speak to this very different and scary and interesting world we were now in. Usually a magazine would be made really over months. I mean, if you take all of its aspects, it's a long journey, haul, whatever. So we made a magazine in 36 hours that was in some ways the best magazine I ever made. Because of the urgency of the moment, we made a particular set of decisions. The decision was, we're going to focus just on this day, what happened this day. And that was a fantastic limit. And we're going to bring in all the talent we'd been assembling all these years. And they, because they were all in their own states of agitation, which also was a creative stimulus for them, they were able to create these things overnight that we then worked into a kind of tapestry magazine with these observations, impressions, sensory experiences that were combined with this incredible photography that we'd assembled. And on the cover of the magazine, we found a memorial, which actually came into being, called the Towers of Light, that was just imagined in the last 24 hours. And I just will say that the magazine, out of circumstance and constraint and kind of new supercharged condition, we were able to make as perfect a magazine form as I've ever been associated with in my career. David Simon, where something happens by himself and then it's subject to a completely other inquiry, which happens in David Simon's case. There was this wonderful phrase called the bounce that came up, which is how creativity works, is the way a ball might bounce in a group. It bounces from one person to another and then they bounce it back, and it achieves more velocity when more hands are on it, and the bounce has a life of its own. I absolutely related to that as a creator. The bounce in one's own brain was the trickiest aspect. I could have written a whole book about collaboration. It's a very, very hard thing to capture, even if you're making a documentary or something. There was a kind of famous documentary that played a role in this book, which was Peter Jackson's reconstruction of the making of the album Let It Be, the Beatles album. And there's a moment, just a very fast moment in the documentary where Paul McCartney has a guitar and he's just riffing on the guitar, and you hear the first chords of the song Get Back. And it's just amazing, because you actually see the moment of emergence of a particular work that you know, and it feels miraculous. But of course, it isn't miraculous. Nothing is really miraculous. Everything has a reason. Everything comes from somewhere. So that's it. Anyway, that was the project of the book. When I was growing up, I didn't know what an editor was. There were no such models for that. But I was extremely attracted to the magazine form when I was a kid. I lived in the suburbs, and the magazines were my ticket to the kind of sophistication of adult city life. I used them. I just immersed myself in them as a very young child and became attached to them as a portal to a world that I wanted to belong to. So when I graduated college, I tried to find a job in magazines, and for various happenstances, managed to get one. I tried to be a writer, like everyone tries to be a writer, because that's what seems to be the only thing you do in that. And I suffered for it. I mean, I was lonely. And I looked and I noticed that there were all these people who were actually doing something that was much more interesting to me, which was that they were behind the scenes, but they were also imposing on this periodical form, this thing that appeared and then appeared and then appeared, making this thing. It just felt like the kindergarten projects that I had been doing as a child. It just seemed like fun. And I learned, once I was transferred to the role of a young editor, just how creative those positions can be. You come up with the ideas, find the right person to do the ideas, figure out how to tell the story. If you're the head editor, you basically figure out what the personality. You are the guiding spirit of the magazine. And that was something that I aspired to do. That's what I wanted to do. It was the great era of print, the last great era of print, when I was coming up in magazines. But then as soon as it also became digital and the digital looked like its future, I became quite entranced with the possibilities of digital journalism. They seemed just as creative to me. The sort of last big chunk of my career was figuring out how to translate the values of print magazines into a world of animation and sound and graphic and interactive storytelling. That was amazing. I was very lucky to have been a magazine editor and to sort of traverse these two eras of it during the last, whatever, half century. I find myself interested in all the things that journalism becomes on its way to the next thing. But of course, the world we live in is very challenging, and I'm not sure that journalism is the answer to the challenges that we have. It's helpful as a tool, but there's something much more seriously complicated going on. And one day I just decided, without having any background in art at all, that I would try to take advantage of the ghosts and paint. So I painted a painting a day. And that was a humbling and learning experience, but I really enjoyed it. And I came back to New York and decided to paint more seriously, although I still had this job as an editor, which was more than a full-time job. And then I finally quit my job, and then I decided to try to paint full-time until I wrote this book, procrastinated, as you said. So that's how I got into painting. And then I got some skills training, and I took classes and that kind of thing. But basically, I just found the act of putting paint on a canvas to be enormously satisfying, even if it frustrated me to no end. I just wasn't good at it.
Well, you say wasn't. You're still painting.
I am, and I'm still not very good at it. But one of the things the book taught me was that nobody really is fully satisfied with anything that they do. And there was a refrain in these conversations I had with artists where I asked them to exult at the making of the thing that they that we've just been talking about. I kind of wanted a happy ending. I wanted an ending to like, oh my God, and I figured it out and bam, fireworks. I made this great thing. I never got that. I never got that sense of closure or epiphany or catharsis in the making of the work. What I got was that the next day I said, yeah, I was fine. And then the next day I went back to work. And what really consumed me was the making, not the thing that I made. I resisted that for a long time. And then I found that to be unbelievably liberating. So that I go into a painting studio right now and I just find the act of making so deeply moving to me that I care less. I can't say that I don't care at all, but I care less about what it is that I've made and more about the feeling of making it. Every story in my book is different. Everyone has a different way of doing things. But there is one thing, there are several things that were in common. But one of those things was the main action was to simplify. The main action was to make the complicated simple. What comes out of your head is just a big mess. And the work is very much figuring out the simplest version of that. That's what makes the work so powerful, is that you're able to find the clear in the complicated. At the moment, I feel just as scared and discouraged as they all do, so I'm not really in a position to offer hope. But I do feel hope because I do believe in human resilience, and because of that education, I have some sense of history, which is that we have lived through very, very scary periods, scarier than this one, and survived. And I have to hope that we will again. But it's challenging, and I think it's useful. The only thing I would say to young people, because I'm just obsessed with this, is that they have to know the past. They have to actually take some time to understand what it is that got us here. And then I think that they would take less for granted the world that has been built, which has lots of problems, but nevertheless is largely overall a story of progress. And I think a lot of young people that I know just don't, you know a lot about, for whatever reasons, education has failed them. And they don't know a lot about how precious this thing that we now, they only see what's awful about our present, which I understand. But it's also in many ways a wonderful story. And they should know that story, both to feel hope and also to know what it is they're fighting for.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thanks for listening.